Good morning. On today's programme, the Scandinavian countries making preparations in case of war, and why Rome is seeking to profit from the famous Trevi Fountain. But first we go to Canada. It's been a tumultuous week in Canadian politics. It began with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announcing that he will step down. He'll stay on until a new leader is chosen. And against the backdrop of this uncertainty lies the threat of crushing tariffs from incoming US President Donald Trump, as Dan Karpinchuk now reports.
Trudeau's resignation announcement came as no surprise. His minority government has sputtered along, fending off no-confidence votes from the opposition Conservatives. Trudeau's popularity is also at an all-time low. His Liberals trail the Conservatives by as much as 20 points, according to some polls. That's been the case for most of the year. And the New Democrats, the third party, have propped up Trudeau's government for the past couple of years, and last year they pulled out of that agreement. The polls suggest that if an election were called today, Pierre Poilievre and his Conservative Party would win a stunning majority. So Poilievre has been pushing for an election at every turn, forcing confidence votes and hoping to bring down the Liberals. Trudeau also faced a mutiny within his own Liberal ranks, with many backbenchers calling for him to quit. It all came to a head in mid-December when Trudeau's Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister, Chrystia Freeland, quit her cabinet post. She had already been at odds with Trudeau over monetary policies. She had also been one of his most loyal cabinet ministers. Trudeau said he would take the Christmas break to consider his future. And on January the 6th, he said he would step down when a new leader is chosen. Enter incoming U.S. President Donald Trump, sensing weakness in Canadian politics. He had already threatened devastating tariffs of 25% on all Canadian and Mexican products as soon as he takes office on January the 20th. He had also mocked Trudeau as the governor of Canada and suggested it could become the 51st state. A couple of days after Trudeau's resignation announcement, Trump, in a speech, was more explicit about his speculation in annexing Canada. He posted images of Canada and the U.S. as one country, and Canada covered with the stars and stripes. What had been taken, north of the border, as Trump's humor, was no longer being taken as a joke. Using stronger rhetoric than he had in the past, Trudeau said there wasn't a snowball's chance in hell that Canada would ever become a part of the U.S. Other Canadian leaders echoed that sentiment. And for most Canadians, there was some anxiety over the possibility of becoming the 51st state. Until a new Liberal leader is chosen, Trudeau must still carry the torch for Canada. He traveled to the U.S. this week to attend the funeral of former President Jimmy Carter. While in Washington, Trudeau also appeared on CNN to make the case for Americans against the Trump tariffs. Meanwhile, the Liberal Party, which hasn't held a leadership convention in more than a dozen years, crawled into action. Party rules say a leadership vote must be held within 90 days, but that's going to be trimmed to about 60 days. Political candidates will be making their public pitches over the next while. Some have already started sending out signals that they're interested in the top job. Insiders say that the Liberal Party needs a tough leader, willing and able to take on Donald Trump and his tariff threat. One possible successor is Chrystia Freeland, whose resignation last month escalated events in Ottawa that led to Trudeau's announcement. Many Liberals have expressed support for her taking the top job. Freeland showed skill in dealing with Donald Trump during his first term and was instrumental in shaping the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Pact. She's dealt with Trump before. She's smart. She knows him. And the fact that he has said he doesn't like her could be a bonus. Another big name under consideration is Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of Canada as well as the Bank of England. Carney has already been canvassing Liberals to test the waters. He addressed a Liberal convention in 2021 and has been a special advisor to the party, becoming the chair of a task force on economic growth. Sources say that late last year, Trudeau and his senior advisors were trying to recruit Carney to the federal cabinet. With a new leader, the Liberals would almost certainly shave some of the lead in the polls held by the Conservatives. Pierre Poilievre is already campaigning, trying to paint all Liberals with the rhetoric he used against Trudeau. But there's a possibility that the anti-Trudeau sentiment from the public isn't an anti-Liberal sentiment. Poilievre is also an unknown as far as taking on Trump, and Canadians may be wary of handing him the baton in the coming fight over tariffs and Canadian sovereignty. For now, the Liberals, still under Trudeau, will make the first moves against tariffs and protecting Canada. Parliament will resume at the end of March with a new Liberal leader. But there's little question that on the first confidence vote, the Liberal minority will be brought down and the country plunged into an election campaign in late April or early May. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Next, we go to Denmark. A number of Nordic countries have begun creating domestic contingency plans in case of war. Citizens in the region are becoming increasingly aware of growing tensions with Russia, as several of their governments have emphasized public-level precautionary measures to address security concerns. Owen O'Sullivan has this report from Copenhagen.
Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, the Nordic region has received significant global attention. The sabotage to the Nord Stream gas pipeline and damage to underwater infrastructure in the Baltic Sea, Finland and Sweden's decision to join NATO, the Russian Navy's necessity to traverse through Scandinavian waters to reach the Atlantic, these have all shone a spotlight on the strategic importance of the area. For the average Scandinavian citizen, however, it is the recent domestic contingency plans that seem to have the largest impact on daily life. Governments across the region have emphasized public-level precautionary measures to address the growing security concerns. Steps designed to ensure their citizens' safety have made it very clear to the people what is actually at stake. In November, the Swedish government distributed copies of a booklet titled If Crisis or War Comes. The arrival of this publication on 5 million Swedish doorsteps has sparked concern among some. The booklet, which gives practical advice in the eventuality of war, such as stockpiling food and how to build a bunker, has been periodically distributed since World War II, but this latest version has the sense of underscoring the gravity of the current geopolitical climate. Jennifer, a writer based in Malmö in southern Sweden, shared her thoughts with me, explaining how her daughter said the situation makes her anxious, while on the other hand, one of her friends thinks it's common sense to prepare, even going as far as buying Jennifer a wind-up radio as a Christmas gift. Jennifer also noted that many in her social circle feel uneasy about Sweden's choice to set aside their neutrality in favour of NATO membership, formalised in 2024, and question whether it offers sufficient preventative security. Sweden's membership has already begun to influence foreign policy. For instance, Sweden's opposition Social Democrat Party recently urged the government to invoke a NATO article that would force a special meeting of the alliance in reaction to damage to underwater cables off the Finnish coast, a sign of the government's security concerns. Similar measures have been taken in neighbouring Denmark, who have urged households to prepare for emergencies. In June, it advised citizens to stockpile 3 days' worth of food and water. According to the Danish Emergency Management website, this guidance was issued in response to the serious threat of man-made incidents, such as cyber attacks and sabotage, due to the deteriorating security situation in Europe. This move has created conversation around the topic of preparedness and war. But for most, it still seems like a minor issue. Peter Poulsen, a CTO in Copenhagen's cybersecurity sector, took a moment to reflect on the situation before telling me that, while it makes him slightly uneasy, it still seems distant. I try not to dwell on it too much, he said. And while he admits he has not yet stockpiled 3 days' food and water supply, it's something he wants to do eventually. But for now, it feels disconnected from my current reality and day-to-day life, he told me. This feeling of distance was not echoed by Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen, who, while recently speaking to DR, the national broadcaster, said the intelligence services in our defence alliance estimate that Russia is rearming so quickly that they could potentially attack a NATO country within a few years. Meanwhile, Norway has focused on medical preparedness. The Norwegian Radiation Protection Authority advised citizens to stock up on iodine tablets as protection against radioactive iodine in the event of a nuclear incident, prompting some to grapple with important decisions. Kevin Glow, a project manager and father in Oslo, described to me how he had to give permission to the local kindergarten to administer iodine tablets to his child in the event of an emergency. When asked about how he felt about these measures, he replied, "I don't think it's about being happy or unhappy about the measures. It's more of a case of feeling disappointed that the tensions in Europe and around the globe are heightened." Given that NATO recently announced plans to increase its presence in the Baltic Sea, and Estonia has now sent a patrol ship to safeguard underwater cables, stating that it expects Finland to follow suit, it does not look like tensions in the region will be easing anytime soon. However, the people living there still hold hope for a diplomatic solution. As Jennifer from Sweden said, "I think it's really important for politicians to continue exploring peace, even though we know it's hard to negotiate." For World Report in Copenhagen, I'm Owen O'Sullivan.
Finally, we go to Italy. The Trevi Fountain is one of Rome's biggest tourist attractions, drawing more than 4 million people a year. but catching a glimpse of the fountain may soon come at a cost, as the city looks to profit from its popularity. Josephine McKenna has this report.
It's a sunny winter's day in Rome, and the city's world-famous fountain is surrounded by hordes of tourists. Visitors are clamouring for the best view of the Baroque masterpiece and searching for an ideal position to toss a coin over their shoulder or take a souvenir selfie. Designed by architect Nicola Salvi, the fountain was completed in 1762 and became a feature of the so-called Grand Tour favoured by aristocrats in the 18th and 19th centuries. In recent years, its status has grown after being immortalised in the iconic 1960s film La Dolce Vita and popular TV shows like the Netflix series Emily in Paris. These days, the Trevi Fountain seems to be on everybody's bucket list, and it's hardly surprising. It's a remarkable piece of architecture with origins dating back to ancient Rome. Embedded in the facade of the Poli Palace, the fountain draws water from one of Rome's early aqueducts called Acqua Virgine, which dates back to 19 BC. Winding your way through the Eternal City's cobblestone alleys, it's quite incredible to stumble upon a monument attached to the side of a two-storied palace and discover its grand statues of Greek gods and feisty stallions emerging from the water in front of you. Measuring nearly 50 metres wide and 26 metres high, the fountain's dimensions are impressive. And visitors from Australia, the US and other parts of Europe are quick to tell me how spectacular it is. Up to 15,000 tourists visit the Trevi Fountain every day, and too often they're seen gorging on gelato and pizza around the fountain's perimeter. Some have even been caught and fined for diving into the water. Last year, two American women in their 50s were fined for jumping in on a Friday afternoon. A Swiss tourist was fined €550 for a dawn dip. And a 40-year-old Indian tourist was also caught wading into the fountain. Now a new queuing system has been installed to prevent large crowds from massing around the landmark. Numbers are limited to 400 at a time at the fountain's rim. On the day I visited, tourists told me they'd waited only 5 minutes before being allowed to access the lower level, where they could take a quick photo and toss a coin over their shoulder. The queuing system was introduced after the fountain was closed for 3 months' maintenance late last year at a cost of nearly €330,000. Its poor condition was highlighted in 2012 when bits of its cornice began falling off. Diagnostic samples revealed significant degradation and the presence of a red patina caused by iron accumulation inside the fountain. It was finally drained to allow its stone surfaces to be scrubbed clean from mould and pollutants and for its grouting to be repaired. The fountain's water reticulation was also upgraded to improve the flow of water and preserve the aesthetic and structural integrity of the monument. When it reopened in December, the mayor of Rome, Roberto Gualtieri, said imposing a limit on access would allow everyone to better enjoy the fountain without crowds or confusion. Now the city council is toying with the idea of introducing a fee for tourists. In the meantime, the tradition of tossing a coin in the fountain remains popular. Mimicking scenes from the 1954 romantic comedy Three Coins in the Fountain, tourists believe that making a wish while tossing a coin will bring them back to Rome. Few perhaps realise their coins are also a valuable source of funds for the Catholic charity Caritas. City authorities collect more than €1.5 million in coins from the fountain every year. The Trevi Fountain's recent maintenance was completed just in time for the Catholic Church's Jubilee year. Rome has more than its share of fountains, but this one is arguably the jewel in the crown. With more than 30 million tourists expected in the Eternal City in 2025, one of its finest assets has been scrubbed and polished and never looked better. For World Report, this is Josephine McKenna in Rome.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.